December 2011 meeting of the Water Rights Advisory Council's order. First of all, thank you, you are the valiant, coming out. I'm sorry, I'm not such a guest. Our first item is public comment, and I don't believe there's any public comment. Next item would be the approval of the agenda. We'll consider approved unless there are objections. And I don't believe we have any next meeting minutes.
No.
So we'll move on to our guest. Also valiant for staying with us on this stormy night, Carol Hissel, the Deputy General Manager of Administration, who's gonna give us our first look at the FY 2013 budget. So welcome, Carol.
Great, thanks very much. So I've got a presentation that we here to have here tonight, and that I gave to the Finance Committee Board last Thursday. So I'd like to ask you all if you want me to go through this page by page, or would you like me to try to summarize it for you in history behind us? I really want to do what's important and, you know, serve your best. What do you think?
I think it's sideways. Summary with anything.
Okay, yeah. So I have.
You can get it to the weeds.
Right, because I have, you know, you all seen the chart, you've seen the presentation. So, that said, let's get right to it. As we have developed the budget this year, we've done a couple of different things. We've tried to attempt at making a multi-year budget, which actually is a very good opportunity to do a couple of things. Sort of puts a picture ahead of for what's going to happen in 2014 and 15. Gives us a better way to plan. It gives a lot more transparency in some of the things that we're looking to do. It also links some of the investment that we have to make on the capital side, right? So you're always looking at a budget and the operations budget, and you're looking at a capital budget. You need to link the two. So it's actually a very good practice that we started this probably process in the late summer. That being said, what does it boil down to on the operating side, which is really what most people are concerned about? It means that we have about a $124 million expense growth from year to year that we have to determine how to fix or how to fund, actually. And one of the ways we've done that, and let me just talk about the 124, what it's made up of. I look at most of my costs, as you know, we've been here before, most of the costs associated with our expense budget is in labor. And labor for salaries and wages in order to run the bus and rail and the drivers. So when we look at the labor cost, we see a slight growth, and it's actually due to very slight increases and step increases that we have currently under collective bargaining agreements. The other impact that we have, because we've underinvested in maintenance, inspection, and what I call maintenance expenses, we actually, over the last decade, we actually are looking at positioning another 40, I can't remember the number, or 50 rail maintenance technicians within the rail budget. And that's a preliminary budget. We're actually looking at that now, but that's what was presented on the Thursday. That's the increase on the labor cost. And it's in the realm of $700 million, you know, give or take several million, but I don't have a number in my head, actually. But so when you look at labor costs, that's a slight increase from the prior year. The biggest increase, and I've said this year after year, are the pension and the fringe associated with labor. If I look at the last decade on our pension contributions, it's been probably about 150%. Growth over a 10-year period. That's a lot. And when we think about our workforce, we have 11,000 people, of which probably 8 or 9,000 are our union, of which most of them are under 689 union, which has a pension contract that indicates they employers are responsible for the contribution of that pension. So many of you work for the federal government or a private entity, and you have a 401k, and you participate in that potentially, right? You may pay 3% towards of your income, or you contribute 4% of whatever the max is allowable. Our union contract here with the predominant employees that we have do not contribute any portion of their income or salary to that pension cost. The burden of the pension contribution is borne by Metro. And what happens over the years, if I look at the last 10 years, because we've taken a look at this, a lot of the, we've had great years in the beginning, back in 2003, when the value of the pension was good. And Metro did not have to contribute to that, because you were seeing the value in the stock market, and the value of the pension was increasing over time. In the dark years, in 2008, 2009, things started to crumble, the value of the pension reduced. And as a result, the employer was obligated to actually fund that pension to make sure that it came up to the value that was indicated in the collective bargaining agreement. So, that's the biggest portion of the increased growth year to year. The other piece is associated with just what I would call CPI, you know, materials and costs and supplies. But generally speaking, labor and the associated fringe and benefits are really the majority of the increase year to year. That being said, so when we look at the expense line on it, it comes down to about a $66 million growth increase. And what we've done is we've added choices for the jurisdictions. All the jurisdictions have competing entities. They have fire to fund, police to fund, education to fund. And we heard that loud and clear. So what we wanted to do was lay out a choice for the jurisdictions that said, you can take, there's about $35 million of projects that are associated with bus priority corridor networks, associated with more security on the bus, that are associated with a better reliability on escalators and elevators, and you can invest that $35 million and you'll get a good return because the performance and the reliability on those things will be this. You've indicated what those KPIs are. So you give the jurisdictions a choice rather than just saying this is what we want. The other $20 million that we're talking about is really associated with adults. Typically, that's not really a choice. The choice was made years ago. So if we look at that $66 million in expense growth year to year associated with predominantly labor, I look at the $20 million associated with Dallas, and I look at the $35 million that's associated with the choices that the jurisdiction made. And then I look at the revenue picture, and they all total up to this $124 million gap. The revenue picture, I'll take a little bit of time to talk about. We actually are probably seeing flat year-to-year growth on revenue, slightly down, actually. I believe the number this year in our revenue for passenger revenue, bus and rail, is about $812 million. And what we're projecting next year is about $809 million. I spent a little time talking to the board about this, and there's a lot of things associated with forecasting techniques that we use. You ask yourself the question, why is revenue going down? Well, there's a lot of different reasons. Predominantly, rail ridership is going down due to economic conditions associated with the region. If you recall why Metro was built, it was built to actually take people in the outer ring and bring them into the jobs in the district. When you have the number of jobs that are just decreasing in the district, you actually have that impacts the rail ridership. Or people coming in using the system. And that's the predominant reason why we have actually a slightly flat growth, low growth rail. On the bus growth, we actually see bus growth in ridership this quarter. I think over the last several months, I've seen a list of growth that's reaching 6%. And that's really attributed to a lot of different things. I'll tell you, it's attributed to the fact that we've got new paper in our system, so no longer do people have to do paper transfer on the bus. And if you think about that, we rely on the bus driver to tap that little button on the fare box when someone would come in with a paper pass. It wasn't very reliable. Now I have most of my riders using smart trip cards on the bus, you know, probably a market penetration of almost 90%. And as a result, we're getting a lot better data. So because we're getting better data, we're counting the number of passengers in a lot better way. The other thing that bus ridership is driving bus ridership that we're seeing in the next several months is because we've actually had a lot of work on the weekends, if you've seen. We've had allergies, ground allergies, this year, the Coop Tech did a good job investing in the areas that need to invest on level one. So we have a lot of bus bridging, and we do have a lot of bus people actually, instead of taking rail, because they're actually taking the bus. So, I have not projected that sustainable 6% growth in bus. We're actually, because of some of the variables that we're looking at in the future, economic variables we get from Moody's and just the population and the district, we're really looking at more of a decline from that 6% on bus ridership. All in all, that really gives you a revenue picture that is pretty similar to the one that I'm living with then. So if you put those things together, you still have this $124 million you've got to figure out how to solve. The way we position this is that we feel that the expense growth of the $66 million should be associated with a fare increase, because it's really, we're asking the riders to pay for that, because this is how, this reflects our current service as it is now. Costs have gone up, and actually that's really what the fare increase would fund, the increase in expenses. The other $60 million, just to make it easy, 60 or 64, we're looking to get a jurisdiction subsidy. And we're looking for them to make the choices on the projects that we've positioned, that I stated earlier. So it gives the jurisdictions a choice if they want to increase their subsidy to fund certain number of projects or not. And so that's how we positioned the budget this year. Going back to the fare increase, so if we look at that, we have to come up with a couple of different ways to raise fares to accommodate for the increase in expense. So we're looking at a number of $69. If you recall, 2 years ago, the fare increase, the projected fare increase was about $108 million. So it's not going to be close to that. So we're looking at a few different options. And the chart that that we just put up here actually shows how we've looked at the fare increases. We want to make sure that we abide by the principles that have been adopted by the board. We wanted to make it simple. We wanted to make it easy. We wanted to make sure that we were equitable. We wanted to make sure that we met some of the guiding principles that were established by the board last year. And so as a result of that, we said, okay, let's do a couple of scenarios and figure out, you know, how we can adopt a fare increase that meets many, if not all, of those criteria. And so one of the things, when we laid out on Thursday, and we'll continue to lay out in the general manager's budget in January, will be those concepts. And so I'll take you through them, and then after that, actually, I'd love to take a bunch of questions, because I know there's a lot of information. So if you go to the next chart, John, if you pick that next chart. So the first concept that we thought about was, well, given that the board has adopted a policy that indicates fare increases would rise by the biannualized CPI, which in this case is about 5.7%. If we did that for bus, on all the bus fares, we increased bus by 10 cents. So $1.50 ride with Smart Trip card would now be $1.60. We also looked at how we can make it, how we can optimize and make the mechanism for collecting fares easy. So we thought about the cash boarding. We were very successful 2 years ago when we introduced the discount for using the Smart Trip card. And that's really what led to the market penetration of people getting Smart Trip card on the bus, because they want to get that 25-cent discount. So we actually brought that concept, you know, to this recommendation. So on the local bus, if you're using cash, instead of paying $1.70, you'd actually, if you have cash, you make the fare $2. Same thing for the express bus. The express bus now is about $3.85. We round that up to $4. It does a couple of things. It makes it easy. It's $2, $4 if you have cash. It also actually optimizes and encourages the use of cost-effective fare meter. It moves people to Smart Trip card. And also actually minimizes some of the costs related to fare fares. You know, you don't have to give change, we don't give change anyway, but we don't have to deal with coins associated with and counting coins and figuring out how to distribute that and then bank it. So that's the bus recommendation. Going on the other side of the house on the rail, we do the same thing. CPI, we have a boarding charge, which is $1.85. Oh, actually, it's $1.95. We'd actually add 10 cents, it would go to $2.05. That would be on the base boarding charge. We also look at possibly increasing the max fare, which is currently now at $5.45. We could increase that to $6. And on the option up here, we also do one other thing. Some of you may not realize it, but there's a great discount when you ride peak and off-peak. Setting aside peak and peak. So if you ride in the afternoon, you could actually benefit by having almost a 55% discount on your fare if you're riding in the afternoon. I think the range is anywhere between 20 and 55%. Depending upon if you have a discounted fare or if you have a senior discount, things like that. So what we're suggesting is, hey, let's try to narrow that discount. And the suggestion here is to narrow the discount to 25%. So if you're riding on off-peak, you would get a 25% discount on your fare versus currently what's in place now. Those three items there actually would raise an enormous amount of revenue, pretty close to the $60 million that we're looking to get. And that's actually a very equitable fare policy, the fare structure. It sort of hits, not just, it doesn't hit commuters as much as it looks at people who are riding off-peak as well. On the next fare concept, we looked at alternative options to the one that I just described. So here's an option that says, let's not hit our regular commuters, right? Morning and afternoon. Let's look at no change in the peak fares. Let's look at no change in the max fares. Keep everything the same. Let's just do one thing. The one thing we do is change the discount in the afternoon, the off-peak. And only give the discount at 10%. So if you're riding in the afternoon, or off-peak, I would say, not just the afternoon, you would have a 10% discount on your regular fare. That one change would drive almost $48 million to your change. We'd lose some ridership, as you see on the chart. But that one change would just, and that would be a very simple change to make, and it would impact, would be equitable, and it would impact, probably less of the commuters. It impacts on the service industry, and that's why you have some loss of ridership, but it does not have a Title VI impact. I would make mention that the fare model that we built in order to associate ourselves with these scenarios all look at Title VI in a very rigorous manner. So everything that we've put up here would be very fair enough. The next chart, we didn't want to leave out parking, since we left parking out the last few go-arounds, actually. So we didn't want to just slap an increase on parking, which is the first bullet you see here. We wanted to do other things as well. So the first recommendation is increase parking by 25 cents. The second recommendation is we have reserved parking parking welcome passes. And if you recall, a couple years ago, we increased that to $65 from, I think it was from 50. And we actually lost a lot of revenue because we did it at the wrong time. We increased reserve parking, and what people ended up doing in this economic market was, it's not worth getting reserve parking. I'll take my chances and try to determine whether or not I can park, and get a space. And that actually worked out for a lot of people because of the lower ridership that we were getting, there's probably actually more allowable spaces in that lot. What we're recommending here is going back and reversing the reserve charge to $45. It really is more of a demand model, as much as we can actually say it's a demand model. But it actually allows us to, and also the leg of that stool is to increase the amount of parking reserve spaces that we reserve currently. Under board policy, for some reason, they limit us at 15% of the parking spaces have to be reserved. And what we're asking for is to just raise that cap to 30%. And that we would actually, based upon the demand of each lot, we would determine what that ratio should be. So it would be the same at 100% utilized lots versus, lots that have a lower utilization. So that's kind of the basic on the parking fare. If you go to the next chart, I think this is the last one. So the other, we've combined two concepts here together. That's not to say we can't split them out, but we've combined two. And the two are, we are recommending removing Peak of the Peak. We did some analysis on this last year and with the data that we had, and looked at whether or not it really did what we thought it would do, which was move people off, move riders actually off to the shoulders. And based upon the determination, we did not really achieve that effect. We actually, in all fairness, we are looking at it again, because, you know, 4 or 5 months of data does not make a very good analysis. And I think I've asked Michael Eichler to take a look at that again, so we can actually understand whether or not that's really working. Let's say, just for this concept, remove Peak of the Peak and introduce what we call a two-zone visitor fare structure. So, and this concept was born out of the fact that we have a lot of paper in our system still that we want to get rid of. Paper meaning the magnetic tickets that people ride. You know, casual riders, occasional riders. Most people are on Star Trip cards. But paper is expensive, it costs money. Not only the paper, but the ticket machines that deploy them, we have to maintain them. There's a lot of associated costs with paper. And so in order to get paper out of our system and move people to Smart Trip, how do you do that? Well, one way to do that is to incent people and make it really difficult for a high price to pay with cash. So what we decided to do was take a visitor zone, and we drew a concentric circle around the map, and we bordered it, I have it up here, we bordered it by what we call the places of destination where people go. So on the north, we have, I think it's Woodley Zoo, probably on the east, we have Stadium Army, Blues Navy Yard, south, of course, Ronald Reagan Airport, and on the west side, we have, at Roswell. And if you travel within that zone, no matter what line you're on, and you're using a paper ticket, you would pay for one ride, regardless of the amount of stops you make, $3. If you're traveling outside of the concentric zone, and you're traveling, at any line, within outside of that internal core, you would then pay $6 for one trip. Now that might seem pretty enormous, and actually we have a lot of questions in the board about this, because that says if someone is taking a paper ticket and going from Vienna to East Falls Church, which I think maybe three stops, they would have to pay that $6. But again, it's incenting people to Smart Trip card. We were in London about a month ago, and we're looking at TfL. TfL does a very good job of moving people out of cash and into onto their Oyster card. And if I look at what they charge for this type of fare structure, they actually charge more for cash customers. I think it's $7 to their account. So it's not unique to us. TfL is doing it, and maybe some other transits trying to get out of paper. And so this is just a recommendation. But I think again, it drives a lot of revenue in our system. The two visitor zone versus the Peak of the Peak. The Peak of the Peak would lose revenue, about $12 million, and then the tourist zone would actually make up for that. It's 15, so it kind of nets off to that. So those are the concepts that we have that we've actually, it's not meant to be exclusive. We're actually, tweaking them as we get more information. And Michael gets a lot of help from the bloggers and some of the planners and folks that help with grading and getting an idea. But it will be part of the general manager's budget in January, and so that it can be as broad as possible in order to get the public input that we require in order to really more balanced budget. So, I'm open to questions. Unless a lot.
Thank you very much, Carol. We'll go around in our usual order, starting with Chris and Brent Pitt.
I'm a pass user, and that's presently paper. Is there a prospect of any update on when it may be a part of the plastic world?
Well, we put the bus passes right on Smart Trip, I think last December. And the rail is actually coming, I think, in the next few months, actually. So we're looking to put the rail pass on the Smart Trip card as we deploy, new features to that card. I don't have an exact date, but I'm going to.
Andrew Carroll, our funding for my committee come days ago, but just for this committee, so that you have a sense of what we're interested in, Carroll, we're looking at working with Carroll on the metro access fares. There's, they're complicated, lots of different combinations, and it's difficult for individuals sometimes to figure out what the fares are. So using what the strategies that you're working for with Carroll, we want to look at our options so that we can have a fare system for metro access that's going to be a win-win situation. And it's going to model after principles of fairness and ease of use and all that you stated at the beginning. And the relationship that we have with you, as I said Monday, we really appreciate. We appreciate your candor and your willingness to work with us whenever we've asked you for information and for information on the staff. We've got that information. It's not always exactly what we want to hear sometimes, but that's okay too.
But you reminded me, Patrick, and that's very sweet. That's very nice of you to say. You reminded me, though, I missed something that I did not get a chance to talk about on Thursday, but was in the presentation, was our work associated with what Patrick is talking about in developing and deploying a fare calculator. And a fare calculator will be an app that my IT folks are working on, which will actually make it easy, specifically for metro access folks as well as anyone else, to calculate what their fare is on either smartphone or iPhone or whatever device they have. The whole point of developing that, and that's something we can deploy, I think we're looking to deploy that in the spring, before we get down to the end of the year. But we're also putting together a prototype. This is happening in IT as well, which is a fare calculator in the system. And so if you think about it as a flat industrial size iPad, it's probably bigger than this, a laptop. And it's standing on a pedestal, right? And so it's next to the TVMs, the ticket vending machine. And it's touchscreen. So instead of going the whole thought is to get customers not approaching the vending machines. As you know, we introduced the website, you have auto load on your structured cart via the website, and we want people to use that more. And so if we've done that, now if you want to know what your fare is, you don't have a smartphone, you don't know what the fare calculator is, you go right to that prototype. You touch it, and this is where I'm going, this is where I'm ending, and it automatically comes to the fare. So I think that's very powerful because there's a lot of users of our system, whether they're tourists, they're occasional users, they're in the nation's capital. I mean, there's a lot of different people using our system. And I've even had people visiting me and flying up from Reagan National Airport, and they want to use the system, but they have no idea. And they're just like, fumbling. So we've actually demoed this with some people in our guests and great ideas. So Patrick, thank you for reminding me about that.
And just as an offer, some of the resources that I have, the work I do with the Department of Veterans Affairs, is to make sure that applications such as the ones you'd use on iPhones and Androids meet accessibility standards. So if you want to tap me, to test that application before it goes out.
Well, I'll have my IT folks call you. They are doing those.
They know me.
Yeah, they know you.
Yeah. But we have the ability to test that for accessibility against Bible standards, and that would be good.
Good.
I was interested in what you said about the union contracts and the cost of pensions, and just correct me, but the union collective bargaining agreement was entered in and agreed to by both sides, the workers and the metro management, the board.
It didn't deal with pensions.
It didn't. How was that negotiated?
That was actually, the pension allocation, that has not been an arbitration discussion. The only thing in arbitration has been wages, and the pension form that I just described, where there's no contribution from the employee, is based upon a contract that was done in 1983 and has never been arbitrated.
Is there any plans to do that?
There are plans to address in this new round of arbitration, a strategy going forward that we can actually put our pension plans in a comparative way with our surrounding jurisdictions, yes.
Okay, good. Because it's just the way that was sort of structured is similar rhetoric that I hear from governors across the country.
Oh, yeah.
And from people running for president. And if these are negotiated contracts, it can be very easy for Metro to, when they're raising fares and having controversy, to push back on unions. And I would hate to see that, those types of tactics being employed, especially in terms of communications that are being employed by governors and other people who are doing it in a completely irresponsible way.
Yeah, it's a very, as you can see just by the climate of the nation, you know, on the states and have this problem. I mean, I will tell you that typically in arbitration, in the past, what Metro has done is typically arbitrated, arbiters want to arbitrate wages. Arbiters are reluctant to arbitrate pensions. It's just it's a fact. And so the discussions need to be had. And so I will tell you that the strategy developing now for labor negotiations do include pensions, they include wages, they include health, they include productivity and work rule changes. It's really the kitchen sink. The fact of the matter is, I mean, that's a lot. And so the approach we're taking is you've got to figure out what you can, as a give and take on these things, right? So you've got to, we're positioning ourselves to have that open dialogue with labor. And actually, I will say that labor and the management are approaching it in a very constructive manner, where they're both looking to get some training, if you will, on how to negotiate. And so that's going to be a collective, which is kind of interesting, that's going to be collective dialogue before both parties get into the real negotiations of that.
Actually, the 100% funding of pensions caught my attention too, because it's certainly highly unusual. And what I'm curious about, and it is a question, since the funding entities probably treat their own employees in the manner where they have to contribute to their pensions, don't you have a lot of trouble with your funding entities with this kind of thing? And do they have any input into the collective bargaining
process? It's a great question. No, the collective bargaining process is with management and labor of Metro. But the decisions are actually made in the direction given by the board of directors. And the board of directors obviously represent the jurisdiction. So there you have it. We will have certain, some of their jurisdictions, like you have Virginia, which is a very different, has different rules, if you will, right to work state than Maryland. But that's where the direction is. In the past, has been, and in the future will be as well. I will say one thing on the pensions I failed to mention. You know, one of the big issues is that we have a very growing body of retirees. And I think it's, don't call me on this, but I think it's maybe 4,500. If you think about it, if someone's approaching, it's actually getting higher as we attrit people, and at some point that's going to be very high, maybe it's not going to be half the population of existing active employees. And so those retirees get a COLA increase. Their pension gets increased by COLA, and that's actually a contract negotiation that we're looking to explore as well, because that actually is very burdensome as well.
The entities don't have a direct input to the collective bargaining system.
They have a direct input with respect
through the directors.
Through the board of directors, that's exactly right.
Okay, thank you.
Let me ask you a little bit of a question, and then I'll get to my thoughts. But say we go with this tourist zone area that you're talking about. I work downtown, and I don't have any commercial cars. I just get on the train. I still would pay the tourist what it would be, the $3 to go wherever.
And make sure you get a car.
Right. No. But that's my question. And not just for tourists, it would be for everyone. It would be for everyone.
Yeah.
Over his calling with them. All right. Before we did this, when I got this email earlier this week, I sent this to the people, because I think what concerned me a little bit about this whole discussion is how much your approach is equitable and equality and things like that. That bothers me a little bit, because when we talk about it in the sense of, if I get on the train here and I get off here, what should my fare be? And that's not necessarily what equitable is. Equitable is more if you can afford something. So that's why we have an equitable tax system. That's why we have an equitable tax system. That's why we have, so that's what equitable means. What you're more talking about is fairness. Is it fair that if I get on at La Plaza and I go to Congress Heights, is it fair that I should have to pay the same amount if someone got on the train three stops ahead of me? That's the difference there, because when we talk about these things and then we look at the numbers, then we start talking about, well, why is it that some of these people are still getting on the bus and basically there are unbanked population? Why are they not using larger cars? And if Metro Ward goes to some of these meetings, so I went to the ANC meeting in Ward 7, and I talked to some seniors who do not use larger cars, and they say, well, because they break. And then when they break, I have to go all the way downtown to get a new one. But I don't normally go downtown, so I just pay in cash. Or because they're hard to fill in, because I don't go to the metro station, so I have to get on the train, put my cash in, and then touch the thing. And I don't have internet access. And then one person told me, Metro's online cash system is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Because why would I pay my cash online and have to wait 2 days to be able to use it? And so I think when we talk about equitable and fairness, there are different conversations around different groups of people. And then when we talk about raising the cost of riding a bus to $2 for the people, this will hit those people hardest. And so I would caution us not, because I don't think that $2 is too expensive. I come from Fresno, California, which is not nearly the size of this metropolitan region. And the $2 bus fares there. So I'm not saying that's too expensive. But I think that before we move that way, we should be more conscious of what is preventing these people from actually moving to these car systems, to the smarter cars, because this is not incentivizing them, this is penalizing them. This is saying, you will use this larger card or you will pay this large fee. That's not an incentive. That's a penalty. And so I would hope that we would do that more before we go into, as I said, I don't think $2 is that expensive for the bus. I use the bus fairly frequently throughout the week, but I would hope that we can solve the problem of why there are these people. But more importantly, my last point is that I was on the bus few weeks ago, and this guy got on the bus with the cash for his trip, but he had his Metro card. He paid for exactly that trip, and he paid whatever the cost is. I used my Metro card, so I don't really know what that cost is. He paid, but he got on, put in his dollar in coins, and tapped his card, so he got the discount. That's not why you want to do this, right? So maybe there's a bigger sociological problem that we haven't figured out of why this one part of the population is so resistant to storing large amounts of money on Metro cards, smarter cards, in order to use them regularly. Because I think that would help us once we realize that, and once we get to the root of what that is, and find a solution to what those issues are, then we can actually bring down the amount of paper that is still existing in the system.
Yeah, that's really great comments. I will say it's a great point about the access. So we are deploying more machines throughout the system that we get in the station. You can actually get a search. I think in some of the stations, I think we're deploying at the gallery place. There's probably about 10 to 15 stations. We'll do that next spring. But you have all great points. Yeah, I think that all we've seen the ridership or the penetration of market smartship cards increase on bus specifically, and it actually has surpassed rail now. I think that you have a good point. A lot of people are loading that day's trip on the bus in order to get the cash discount. But we've actually deployed people around the system to find out where that's happening, find out whether or not it's actually impeding the on-time performance of the route. But we only found it in a couple of places. That's not to say that we can't, we should address that, because those are what you call, I think you used the word unbanked. Those are people that are going to pay for their trip every day, because they're not going to load value on the car, because they may not have that. So I think that those are all valid, valid points that we need to address, and we're looking at trying to figure out how to do that. One of the concepts I did not mention on Thursday, was trying to, we will talk about it actually on Friday, is to reduce the cost of the structured car. I've got new structured cars coming in next spring to replace, the old ship that we can't purchase anymore. Not to say that the old ship doesn't work, it will work. But the new ones will work even better. We're going to put new sleeves on that. Hopefully they won't crack and not work as you indicated. But in doing that, the cost is going to go down for that truck. And so we're looking to possibly pass that on to riders. So that might be a great way of looking at to try to get back a little bit to the riders who actually find owners to buy a special car. But thank you for your time.
Hi. Two quick questions. What's the rate for the current day pass?
Nine.
Is it nine?
$9.
Okay, thank you. Okay. My other question is, don't just make me do this. Recently, didn't Metro remove the discounts from the bus lines in Anacostia?
They removed the. If you're taking rail, if you're taking bus, you're going to rail, they removed that discount.
No, there was the bus lines in Anacostia.
There have been some changes in the bus. That's right.
Well, that seems like a double hit to some people. This year you removed the discount and then you raised the fare again a few months later.
Well, actually, that was done by the district. The district actually subsidized some of the routes in that area, I believe. So under the district's guides, that's what they wanted to do. We did it last year. I can't remember when, but I do remember doing that.
Okay.
So,
I'm just saying, some people that will seem like the most.
I totally agree with you. Yeah, some people will see that as a double hit because on the heels of that happening, now you're actually going to have potentially a fair increase. So now I totally agree with you.
I think that Joseph made a very, very good point, and I think that Metro is still relatively insensitive to the fact that there are some people who budget on a daily basis. They budget day by day, so they cannot afford some of the savings that you can get by using a smarter card loading, et cetera, et cetera. I think that Metro needs to make certain that they maybe stay away from the loaded word equity, because I would agree that equity can mean different things depending on where you were set. And finally, I would be very opposed to anything that smacks of the zone system. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and in my mind, the zone system for chaos, for example, was one where Congress set the limits so that any place that Congress wanted to go in downtown Washington was in Zone 1. And any place that they didn't want to go in Washington, D.C. was in more expensive zones. And I lived through that, okay, where it was amazing. I was a researcher and I could go all around Capitol Hill, all around downtown D.C. for a fare zone. But when I wanted to go to my neighborhood, then I was a free zone, that was a free zone ride. So I think, whatever sensitivities that Metro has, if you're going to go through the trouble of training people before they go through the collective bargaining process and negotiating process, is kind of, there also needs to be kind of an analogous sensitivity to certain words that are wounding or very loaded for people.
I have two questions. How, in this two-zone visitor fare deal with the map, how are fares treated for people who are smart? Because you said it's double for Okay, so that $3, $6 thing only hits you if you.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. It's really, the whole point is to eliminate paper and eliminate confusing cash. And so it was just really an innovative idea to move people off of that.
Gotcha.
Yeah, new paper.
And how, you know, we might be looking at an expiration of the increased transit benefit. How have you factored in that expiration to your proposals? Do you see that affecting ridership and less revenue? And are your projections for revenue and ridership based on the extension of that, or do they assume an expiration?
Great question. So I have assumed that they're going to be rolled over for this year's budget. And if they are not, then I think the annualized number that we estimated is going to be a $16 million loss in revenue. So
if it's not extended.
If it's not extended, that's really probably for FY14. If they're not extended this month, I'm trying to locate a bill to hang it on. I had an email from my Berlin Affairs folks confident that there are a lot of folks trying to do that.
Right.
If it doesn't, then I would say half of that, like the potential risk of $8 million.
Because
it's half of this career. But that's actually just a number. Do I think I'm going to lose $8 million? Sure, no, if the extensions are not rolling. Because typically, customers, it's a long time for them to change their behavior, right, on how they ride, how they get to work. So I will see some loss potentially. But I do not project it's going to be that much. But it could be very significant for FY13 if it's not rolled over this year. That's what I'm more concerned about.
Which would be the start of this one?
July 1. Okay. And so that on the $124 million, I have to plop another $16 million on top of that. Now, I will say on the benefit, it's very, equitable. It's not equitable because actually the parking benefit is being raised, and that makes no sense.
Does is the budget that you'll send to, I assume, I mean, we'll know by the what's going on. Is the budget you'll send one in January? But if it's not extended next week, you're going to be making that change.
I'm positive thinking. That's a good point. I mean, I always have a hard time, but it's always a fine line of being getting as much information at these community meetings and also boiling it down to things that, you know, the public understands. It's always a fine line. You want to be open and accountable. You want to be transparent. But some of these things, some of them are pretty complicated. Some of them are basic. But I do appreciate that. We want to make sure that we, certainly for the public hearings, which we know we'll be moving on, we'll try to be more assisted and happy to understand what we're trying to say.
Thank you.
This is a very informative presentation. There are projections for ridership losses on the different fare proposals. And last year, there were projections for ridership losses. At some point, I thought someone said there was going to be an analysis of how on target those projections from last year worked. Like, you know, if adding the bus fare increase, you know, was projected to lose 2.3 million riders, whatever, hang that up, how much was it? You know, some of them you can't tease apart, you know, on rail maybe, but, you know, to sort of try to estimate that. Was that something that was never done, or was that going to be done, or is that going to be done?
We looked at the peak of the peak to find out whether or not that was done. And we haven't looked at the fare increase. We recall talking about it in public. But we're pretty close. So if you look at our passenger revenue, it doesn't really, you could probably, you could probably indicate, you know, if you have a shorter day, a shorter average weekday in 1 year, you lose 2 million in revenue. That's how sensitive some of these numbers are. If you lose 1 weekday in an average year, you lose $2 million in revenue. We're pretty right on with some of those projections. I just haven't shown in the public. Do we anticipate weather events, right? Like the February snow or the December snow? We don't really anticipate that and bake that in the budget. We anticipate seasonal events, you know, cherry blossom, some of the big events that we know are coming. We have an analysis we just had.
Okay, and so with the fair, some of you just heard it. So your gap closing involves, you're recommending you all of the options that are listed here in the presentation?
No, we're not recommending all those options.
Okay.
That would be like $300 million.
Right. Okay.
We're recommending, they're just concepts that we have. Yeah, any one of them can be used. I will say this, that when we tied a couple concepts together, David, Peak of the Peak and Tourist Fairs, you couldn't split those up because that wouldn't give you the right amount of room. If we had to uncouple them, they would actually potentially have different arrangements of revenue and loss of ridership. They're very tied together, so. But they're all options to be considered.
For the 60
million. Yeah, yeah. The target is really to look at 60 million. And we can probably do that in many different ways. We do that with one chain, which is the, you know, looking at the discount of 10%, or you can do that with a combination.
Okay. You can't get to 60 without the, you can.
Okay.
Yeah, you can. All right, so you have to do either the real fare increase, alternative option, or the real fare increase, which is reasonable, but it has to be one of those two,
right? That's right.
Right. All right, thank you.
I'd like to follow up on the discussion about folks that fall into the unbanked category and some of the other populations that might not be shifting over to the smart truck. I worked as a travel trainer for a period of time working with people with significant cognitive disabilities as well as mental illness. And these folks can't hold on to a smart truck or they lose them all the time. And there's a cost associated with losing them as well as the frustration that exacerbate some of their situations. So while I realize the benefits of shifting folks as much as possible to smart trip, I completely understand and support that. I'm really concerned about this population and what some of these proposals, how it will penalize some of our people that we really want to be using the fixed route because they don't face physical barriers. That's not an issue for them. It's more cognitive disabilities or mental illness, which, you know, if the elevator isn't working, they can still take the train or the bus. So I just want to raise that as an issue. And it might not come up on the Title VI. You know, those studies don't always, I think, reveal these issues.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually. And I'm thinking out loud because as we purchased the commodity chip, getting in February, which actually has a lot more functionality, putting them in the sleeve of a smart chip card and selling that. I can use that commodity chip to put maybe in a key fob, or some other form factor that can actually address the issue that you just described. So that people who are using, who have cognitive abilities or can't actually hold on to a smart chip card, there might be another way we can actually develop a fair media that they could do that. So that's a great suggestion. Thank you.
Well, actually, just to clarify, I wasn't really necessarily talking about people who physically can't hold on to. It was more like they lose things a lot because of this.
Yeah, and so maybe what we do is, love to work with you or anyone on the committee to try to determine how we can develop another, another kind of a form factor that we can actually establish that it would be easy for people to use in order to use a fixed route system. I actually had a the commodity card that was like a little, case thing that you actually put on the back of your laptop, right? It's a smartship card. It might make sense for some, accessibility riders who might have that issue that you just described. Thank you.
Well, Carol, we got our discussion started on the budget, and we'll be, reviewing the, these and proposals that they can have, in the next couple of months, and preparing our response, so we really appreciate your introduction.
Thank you. I always get ideas, so I do appreciate, you know, a lot of the discussion that you gave me, we will address them as we can.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next item is, RAC annual report. This is a suggestion, from David and the vice chairs all agreed that it was a good idea to have, sort of an annual report of what we have done over the past year, the past 12 months. And, maybe you want to add to that?
Board member Mary Hines suggested this, because we had a lot of the Arlington advisory committees, and they had a lot of them in Arlington. And she said that some of the duties came over for us, and that's a good opportunity for the board to kind of remind the county board what it is that they're doing, and, you know, and what they have been doing. And then perhaps that gives the board members an opportunity to talk about, you know, suggestions for directions that the advisory group can take, you know, things that they would like to hear about from the advisory group, you know, and also just have to be reminded about all the good things that that advisory group has done if they haven't kind of done some good things. At the officers meeting, I brought that up, and we thought that maybe we could sit, see John could put together some things that could be delivered to the board in an annual report. So I'm saying this is sort of a rough outline, and that's something, you know, this is just a list of the things that we did, John Gill together, and then, you know, we can turn that into a report with a little bit more in wording form, perhaps, but we thought that the immediate members thought that was a good idea, and then having this list, maybe could give everyone a chance to think about how we're doing that, and any suggestions that they have of how to structure such a report, or, you know, what to emphasize, or anything like that.
Comments or questions? Go ahead.
I just wanted to say it's an excellent idea, and this is very helpful. I even like this format. You know, maybe a couple of paragraphs, but I think this is great to see the bullets at a glance, to see what all the kids are
doing. I also think this is a good idea. I would suggest, is the goal for this to be like posted online? If it's posted like on our website or something, I would suggest linking everything so that, you know, when it says send a letter, it's on here so that you can actually see all the primary sources that we do. I'd also probably suggest having dates for when things happen, whether the letters or what have you. As well as for the monthly meeting mention, I might also put in how many public comments we had. Or members, I mean, I know we don't track members in attendance. I mean, members of the public in attendance, but how many people brought comments at the beginning. I think that would be illuminative. I mean, I think we all know what the answer is, but I think if this is going to be read by the people, it would be helpful for the people to see there is room for growth. But I think it's a great idea. Very good idea. And thank you for pulling it all together.
Oh, who is?
I think, these
are good ideas.
Well, it's a great idea, too. I think one of the things, just visually looking at it, is that we didn't introduce you much in the second half of the year. We sort of slowed down things. And I just I mean, just the visual, you're not reading anything. But I think that's one of the reasons why we should have this report, is so that we do remind ourselves of what we're doing and what more we could do.
Is there any way to include, John, something that, or how are supposed to include some key themes from the meetings or key themes from our presentations in terms of what seem to be the sentiment of the report?
Yeah, not at all. This, it's all, I just went through Frank's monthly reports, and those have the key themes. I guess really what, what would be helpful is sort of to get a sense from everyone, and I don't want to oversimplify this, but basically how long you think this should be, or how detailed, and then I can sort of size it to fit. You know what I mean? I mean, like, if you, adding key themes, if this goes up to 3 or 4 pages, do you all sort of think that that's enough to incorporate everything? Do you want, I mean, that's sort of the information that would be helpful for me, but yes, I guess is the short answer.
My thought is short is good and length is good.
Okay.
I just think this is an excellent idea. I would keep it short. I think if I had to choose between the two things that have been proposed, I would choose the length of the letters and the other thing, rather than picking up the things. I mean, this is going to encourage me to go back to the minutes to see if there's something major, but it seems to cover the things that were done. The only thing I would say is I think that we should include the monthly, just mention the monthly presentation to the full Metro board. We do, and I guess Patrick is actually doing it for the AEC, so but I think that should definitely be included.
Well,
I think this can serve any purpose. It can also give a sense to people who may be interested in joining the RAC of the
right.
My hesitation on themes is that they need to not be opinions. I think you can do topics. When you say themes, the theme would be Iraq was concerned about budget cuts. Well, maybe some people are concerned about budget cuts, or maybe some people don't see XYZ as a problem, and others do. So that would be my concern. I think looking to your report is a good idea and all of that, but I think as soon as you start putting opinions into the report, that's where I have concerns, because I can think of things where like a theme would be mentioned where I don't agree with it pretty easily. Because you either think it's a concern or it's not a concern, or you think we should be spending time or not spending time on it. So I think topics or tags or something would be useful, but I would be leery of anything that is not a clear consensus or an interpretation of the role.
Victoria, do you?
I like the one. Now I think this is great. I would just say also include, I guess, the links and the emails. And then other, when you present it to the board, maybe you give them a packet with all the actual letters and everything, and like everything you link to in one packet, so that they'll have it in one place.
And I think one more thing to add to this is that this year will be the most difficult for you to put all together, because you've only been together 12 months, so it's might be something that could be done on a monthly basis in the coming year, so that it's a work in progress. It could be approved at the end of the year. Okay, if there are no other comments or questions, we'll move on to the next item, which is council information procedures. At the last meeting, it's going to be consensus or at least some requests for, to go back to the issue of how we deal with information requests and to have some sort of procedures for that. The executive committee discussed it this past month, and before that, in what do you want to?
I think that there were some, I mean, first of all, just that there, you know, should we sort of, maybe people wanted to talk a little bit about their views about what transpired as far as the, you know, the resignation of Chris Schmidt and what he said about his reasons and any things that have had. In addition, you know, the whole situation arose because he had been making this request for a long period of time, and, you know, he was sort of working his way through the, you know, process, and we did that bylaw with the board to sort of try to, you know, advance the general cause without being very specific about it, and then he was still kind of trying to get this information, and then, you know, the question, I guess, is really, you know, what would have been appropriate and for future situations was appropriate in terms of should the RAC be looking at these issues earlier in the process. You know, he ended up coming to RAC basically when he'd been completely stymied by going through this process, and at that point, not only the folks in the performance office, but Richard Charlton and Catherine Hodges had reviewed the request. You know, what do we, how do we want to be involved in that earlier? And as people have brought up in previous discussions about this topic, how do we distinguish or how do we create a process that gives the RAC the involvement it wants at the appropriate time that it wants for a request like his, without burdening the more common routine request where someone says, hey John, can you, you know, send around a list of all the bus changes from last month or whatever, you know, is that an information request that several people have pointed out. So what is it that, what role would the group like to have when some future member makes a request like this? Is that cover what you were asking there?
And I think one thing that we were going to propose is that it's open for discussion and debate, but that appropriate time to intervene would be before the request goes up the chain of command. That when, for instance, using Chris Schmidt's example, that when his request was denied by the performance office, before it went up the chain of command to Mr. Swells and Mrs. Hudgens, that it would have come to us first, so that it would have either had RAC support or not as it went up the chain of command. Carolyn?
Yeah, to address what David said, I hope I'm not putting you on the spot. I should have done this earlier. About how many requests do you get, say, per month from RAC members?
I would say not a lot. I would say, I mean, it varies, but probably 2 to 4. I mean, not a large number, generally.
Okay, and of the 2 to 4 that you get per month, how many are significant or how many are versus routine?
I'm not exactly sure how to differentiate the two, but I mean, I would say that Chris's request for all of the data and sort of all of those reports was definitely out of the ordinary, or it was unlike other requests that I've gotten.
My feeling is this, I guess I've got lots of feelings about it. Number one, is it next month that newly appointed members of the RAC will join us?
Yes.
Okay. So I think that this bears some kind of discussion next month, so the people who are joining us will
be part of the discussions, because they're the ones that are going to be carrying on, you know, carrying on. But I would say this, I felt taken advantage of. I felt taken advantage of because of the request definitely implied a rack basis for asking. I don't remember, I don't have it with me. But it definitely, I would say that an outside party or a third party looking at the request would assume that it had the endorsement, the concurrence of the RAC. It was not from John Q. Public. And, you know, my thing is that obviously if you serve on a public body, you are responsible and, you know, you're going to get criticism, but I would prefer to be criticized by things I'm aware of. So what, to me, the situation was a cautionary tale that I don't think that, I think that John has enough sense to know when something is routine and to know when something is unusual. And I would say that if his antenna go up as this is an unusual request, even before it got to the performance office, I would like to have the executive board look at it. And because we went through a lot of trouble in the year before to establish a new governance model where we had more than one person, you know, making decisions. And so I think we ought to use that. So that's what I'm suggesting in the short term. And maybe, you know, from a classic organizational dynamics point of view, it may not be ideal because we're putting a lot of that's putting a lot of faith in a person rather than a position. But I really think that's the way we should do it. I don't think this should have gotten, this request should have been made on behalf of the RAC without the people in the RAC knowing about it. And it should never have left. But the RAC, I mean, it should never have gotten to the performance office. You know, I think we were put in a position to look foolish at best, by the way it was done.
Well, technically, Carol, I would totally agree with you. First, let me say that. Before I say that, technically, it wasn't a request by the RAC, but it sure looked like it.
That's
the problem. Is that if one RAC member requests it, and it's a heavy request, it can look like the RAC is requesting it.
But the letter, and I don't have it written, but the letter specifically had a phrase that said something about RAC. I mean, it was no question, but I'm sorry I don't have it tonight, but it definitely it used the weight of a member of RAC, you know, because I think I've even asked for, you know, I mean, I'm sure we've all had a situation where, let's say, I might say, I'm a member of the RAC, but I'm asking as a private person. That's not what the letter said. It said quite the opposite.
I'm not even going to respond to the resignation, it is what it is, but I will say that I think that, and this is my thoughts on the whole matter of what we should do going forward, I would think that, you know, I've served on bodies before, and normally the rule is we don't speak or act individually. This is the council act of the council, not individually. And so I would think that a good process would be that those requests that are being talked for RAC business or RAC purposes should be brought to the RAC first. And the RAC decides whether or not we want to do that, and then a letter is drafted and a request is drafted and sent on RAC letterhead by the chair to the requesting authority. Even if, you know, if Victoria is asking for some information, she can draft a letter and send it to Frank and say, please put some RAC letterhead. That way, we're making sure that the people upstairs understand that requests from the RAC will come from our chair, and replies to the RAC will go through our chair and back to the rest of us. Because as Carol has said, there was a line in there that said that if you read the whole thing, it may seem as if it was an individual that you were going to use it for RAC purposes. And so if you're going to make the request as an individual, then make it as an individual. And if they say no to you as an individual, then you summon your will as an individual. But I never understood, and I still have to say, I understand what we would do with the information if we were to get it. And so, and I'm confused about that. I mean, I think it might be a legitimate person's purpose, but if someone were to give me, that way if the information is replied to the RAC, then everyone gets the information. and not just one person. Because I feel that if that information was supplied to Chris, and if he agreed with what the information was, or found what problem with what the information was, then the rest of us would have never known that he got this information. Whereas normally I'll use Congress as an example. If the committee of Congress has the executive branch for information, the executive branch sends it to the committee, and everyone receives the information. And then everyone can review the information and draw their own conclusions. And so that's what I would think that we can do in the meantime. And then maybe next January, when we get new members, we can reinstitute this committee, which I was there, David, we were there for like 2 hours, and we talked about the whole plan. And so maybe we can reinstitute this government committee, come up with a new plan, and approve it then.
The one problem that I see, Joseph, with that is, we do have requests that are individual requests, and I don't think we want to sign any those. David, offer an example. What was your example?
I'll offer an example. I asked John why the majority of turnstiles face outward at Adams and Morgan during rush hour in the morning rather than inward. And he found out, and I told the people who had asked about it in my office that were pissed off, and that was great. Like, and yes, I probably shouldn't have distributed that to the whole body. That's an individual request. I think asking.
You asked John, though. You didn't.
Yeah,
I
just
asked John.
You didn't send it to like
the
first
hour
office.
But
John,
actually, I did.
John doesn't know that.
I think we can trust John's treasure, and I think if anyone decides to ask for, you know, an Excel sheet with, you know, the arrival time of every train since the beginning of time, which I don't know why you don't think you would have used that, the rest of us would have, then I think a lot of it is going to be. I think the line we've been walking, frankly, is pretty good and has worked, except for like this one situation. And, you know, if John says that's out of line, or not to empower the faceless bureaucrat, but you know, if John says that's out of line, or I don't feel comfortable in my position getting this for you, then we bring, you know, we have a open forum.
Yeah.
So that would be my take.
You're correct, David.
I was going to say, yes, we could definitely combine Carol's suggestion with Joseph's. My other request for any procedure would be that the whoever receives the information shares it with the rep. Like, it has to be open, they have to share it, that's not negotiable. And that they're very clear about their purposes and what they're doing. And perhaps that they even need to present some kind of short report to the rep. You've made staff go through this effort for the information, and you said you were going to do something with it, so maybe we can see some results. You know, 5 minutes, you know, 5 minutes on what you want to show this. Not just, I think if we're going to make staff go through this, we need to make sure that people are actually using the information that we have a purpose for, that we know what to do.
I certainly think it should probably be distributed to everyone. I would mind seeing what John said to Carl. I don't know if we want to make it, but if that has to be an agenda item on our meeting, because Carl asked that question, you know, because to some degree, there is maybe a role for the RAC rooms a little bit, that like people who have questions and then talk to the RAC room and they know maybe the RAC room or like ask for the help, whatever. And it's not something we need to spend a lot of time on, that turns out. You know, that should be emailed out to everyone, just like FYI, maybe it's with the chair report, and here's all the stuff that, by the way, people asked for this month, and just so you all know, and then we all can know why it turns out to be out of that department, and that's something that it can be. I just wanted to say, while we're talking about this, this isn't certainly on the specifics that we're talking about, but, you know, a couple of times some kind of comments were being made about, like, why would people want all that information about train arrivals? I do feel like, I mean, and then last time, it seemed like there were a number of people here who felt that his request, you know, we should try to find a way to ask for people to accommodate his request. I think that there are a lot of potentially bribe or valuable reasons to want that information. For that matter, I actually think that that's sort of thing that Metro should be releasing, you know, generally publicly. There are actually other transit systems that release data sets like that. People can run an analysis on that. Maybe not all people in this room, but you probably could with Excel. Actually, a lot of people could, you know, run analysis on that. Or do more sophisticated analyses to graph them and be able to show, you know, how does the on-time performance vary from day to day? Is it worse on Thursdays? You know, what about the influence of raining? You know, this is what, you know, let's identify which day, you know, how a single traction, how much does that impact things, whatever. So I can actually think of a lot of valuable uses that could be, that data could be put to. I'm a little bit disappointed, honestly, that he chose to, Chris chose to resign, because I think that what he was pushing on was actually a fairly worthwhile issue, though. It was sort of annoying that he wasn't really sharing with the group what he wanted to do, because I could think of a lot of things that I would do with that data, but he didn't tell us what he wanted to do with that data, so that kind of weakened the case a little bit. And I was thinking, like, you know, why don't we sell all these things, like AppleScript interfaces, and like, I don't want to say. And then resigning, I think, sort of set this now this kind of negativity about the whole thing, and like, now it seems like it must not have been, you know, a good thing for the draft that he went to FedEx. So I'm disappointed that kind of that got dropped as a result of this situation, because I actually think he was, I don't know, actually, his second request, I'm not sure I agree with that the same way, but like that kind of real data, I actually think probably would have, was a very worthwhile thing to push for.
Can I just say real quick, and I don't want you to, as a dead horse, but let me say why my concern is. Earlier when we were starting the public safety committee, I asked John if we could get numbers between how many people actually called the Metro Police number, 7-digit number, versus how many people called 911 and were transferred to the number. Because my big thing is, no one knows that 7-digit number, and so people are calling 911 and being transferred. John told me that that would probably take a significant amount of time to get. And so until I am ready or feel that the committee is moving in a way where we can actually delve into this more, that's when I was going to bring that request to the full body, to have a full body say, yes, that's a significant amount of work, but it's important, and this is an issue that from the end, we all would like to have something done with. So, and so I left it there with John and I having that conversation. That never happened. That's the point that I think that missed. Because when I say I don't know what we would do with that, I mean, no one ever told me that this thing would take a significant amount of time, which apparently we had been told, Chris had been told multiple times by different people that this would take staff a significant amount of time to get. And so I would think that he would come to us and say, hey guys, this is what this is. This would take a significant amount of time to get, but this is what the data is, and this is what I would like to use it for. So when I say I don't know what we would use it for, that's what I mean. I don't know what was ever the goal to use it for. And so that's what I wanted to clarify, that we all should be a part of knowing what the goal is. That way, if I was to bump into Betty Hewlett, who used to be my board member, for planning, and she's like, what is this thing that I got this appeal and everything like this? And I'd be like, I don't know. And so that's my point.
I agree completely. Thanks for the clarification. That makes perfect sense.
Okay, so I'm getting the sense that based on Carol's suggestion that we not move on this until January. But I think that in January, at least, at latest, we should have a committee come up and hash out. We should have a committee meet to come up and hash out, to hash out all the details and come up with a proposal based on some of the things that have been said tonight. Do you want that committee to meet before January and come with a proposal in January, or do you want the committee to meet after January?
Will we have the names of the people? I don't like the idea of sending people stuff.
Yeah. I think the people should get one meeting in.
Okay.
Should have a good one meeting.
Yeah, part of the problem, though, I'm torn on it, is that the new people are not going to have the history of what happened, you know, of this one case. And not to make,
That might be good, you're right.
I mean, we can do an afternoon or evening, you know, for the meeting, but I think, like, they haven't even been appointed yet, right?
Next Thursday.
Next Thursday, so I think that they should be appointed, we should say hello to them, and then maybe we might be able to help them.
Okay.
You're saying have a committee before the January meeting?
No.
Yeah, after the January.
At January, that's when we inform the committee at the meeting that they.
Okay, that sounds good.
There was also a request for us to make an information request from someone outside the group. Was there not, should we talk about that at this point?
I think that request was made to Metro, and we have a seal that's going to be met by the group.
Okay.
It's actually, I mean, it's being worked on in terms of, I actually just got a call from somebody yesterday who's doing follow-up, so.
Dan Jackie, the first chair of the RAC, had some customer service that had at one point been pushing for there to be signs with the emergency numbers posted in buses and trains. And at one point, I think about this year, our emergency came by with a sign that they were going to put up, and he wanted to know how many had been put up and something else.
And what the rate of calls were before the sign and the rate of calls after the sign.
Well, why would he ask us to find that out?
He did, yes.
He asked, and I guess there was some discussion about whether we should ask about that, but apparently it's not necessary, so it's kind of not something we need to talk about.
He asked us to asked if we were interested and would also want that information. And so that may be a supportive second request. Next topic. Questions or comments on the RAC chair and AAC chair reports? You just received the AAC chair report this evening. And RAC chair report yesterday. Victoria?
So you didn't want to mention all of the business with Chris Schmidt?
No. What business?
The RAC report.
I didn't think it was necessary to put that in, that board members would have known about it. They all received his resignation.
I think you kind of let me know.
And that it wasn't RAC activity, other than that he, you know, they were being informed by him about that.
That's true.
I mean, if they didn't, and that would have been good. If he hadn't sent a letter to them, that would have been a different story.
This was hurting, but. Are you saying that we never clarified our position relative to his comment in any way informally? I hope we did with the chair and Richard Charles. Did we do anything to make it clear?
No, we have not yet communicated with Mr. Sauls or with the board chair. Board chair had offered to come to talk about information requests with the RAC.
Well, you know what? I think it would be a good strategy would be we're going to have a discussion in the next meeting, and the minutes will show that. And then we're going to have some sort of discussion. Maybe that will be your report to them would be for whoever the next report will to them would be a good. Vehicle for making it clear that we're disassociating ourselves. Because my problem is, and David, I agree with you that there is, just like Carol Kissel, I think it was very interesting what she said at this end, and I had a chance to really, kind of listen more closely. I thought it was really funny when you spoke and she said, oh, you have some great ideas, and I'm writing down some of them. But what I'm saying is, I think you made a good point. that we are in a better position, I think, in this overall summary of 2011 shows, to ask more probing questions, like, you know, what is going on with the package inspections, et cetera, et cetera, and what is going on with some of these things, and maybe we should try to get into the process before these various proposals sort of get into PowerPoint discussion. So I agree with that. I have a problem with just the process, not with, you know, probing more deeply with, you know, with the questions. But at some point, I think it's important for our own credibility to let it be known and to disassociate ourselves from the way that went down.
It was made very clear, both to Mr. Charles and to Mrs. Hudgens, that this was a request from an individual, at least from staff's end, from Lorda and my end.
I was going to say that I knew that those two
just
knew about it. We did discuss having Mrs. Hudgens come to take her up on her offer, but we thought two things. One, that this being a busy time of the year, it would be better to wait until next year, and two, that so that we would rather her come to discuss a swath of issues rather than just have her come to belabor this point. Right.
So I wanted to add one thing, just I think you did belabor the point. I think the vote on this motion at the last meeting was pretty clear also to people who read the minutes there on the back and stood on the class.
Sure. Sorry, I have nothing to do on this topic. I'm great. I'm sorry, I'm gonna have to do something with my word to make it more interesting, I guess. But I did want to let this group know that one of the areas that we're working at very hard from the AAC side is looking at the new paratransit contract. That contract, probably $800 or $900 million, may be set up a little bit differently than the winner-take-all contract that we're looking at right now, with maybe subject matter experts taking over areas like dispatch, call center, and also looking at maybe hiring another company to do quality assurance with Metro Access. It's, you know, and I know that's in this group's charter, just want to bring it up. We'll have probably the RFP go out by April or May, I think the latest. A decision made by next January, December, January, as far as whoever the new contract will be, with them taking over next July. The other thing that has been significant this time around has been the amount of public input that we never had the last contract before the contract before that. So you have focus groups, you have town hall meetings, three of them, and a lot of the same thing came running over and over again. So there's a lot of good things going on, and there's a lot of one of the things also that one has been to say to our group. We're interested in what you have to say as far as requirements. So we wanted to spend some time at your meeting to talk to us about what technical requirements you want to see put in this RFP. That's pretty cool stuff. You know, we're going out in April. So we're going to be feeding them information as far as, you know, what we want to see on as far as technical requirements. I think there's a lot more we can do as far as access to information for disabled people. One idea being, there's, you know, why do we have to go through dispatch to find out where our vehicles are? We should be able to find vehicles through iPods, iPhones, everything else, smartphones, via your smartphone as opposed to calling up dispatch, you know, access to information, things like that. So we're making progress. It's pretty exciting. It's a very daunting task, but I like the direction Vermont is going to. Transparency and access to information. So that's a big deal that's going on. my committee, and certainly, you know, I can brief you guys as much as Lucas as you want. Or if you really want that whole show, I'll send Rich and Ken over. The whole scoop. But this was stuff.
Carl, did you have a question?
I was just going to ask, do we do elections for chair next in January?
Yeah.
Right? Are there any announcements about that?
There's going to be one right at the end of this, the first one. Let's stick with this agenda. Okay.
Was there going to be a letter about the regional Kansas system plan? Can I just move the general thing that we're going to have the interview about? So in response to the regional Kansas system plan recommendations, we have been thinking that it would be good to have a short letter to the board, encouraging them to encourage staff to present what they have found from the regional transit system plan analysis to the public as early as practical, and get public feedback on, you know, the different options and other elements of the regional transit system plan. Early on in the process, because the reason for this is that it's my understanding that there's been some debate about how much the board should sort of go through all of that themselves before getting feedback versus getting feedback early, and I think that it fits with the writer's wishes and the general sentiments of this group, that we would like them to present these things to the writers early on, as opposed to later. So I would move that we send a short letter basically encouraging the board to encourage staff to share the results of the RTSP with the public and get public feedback as early in the process as practical.
Is there a second to that? Joseph, Patient seconds it. Any discussion or debate?
Have they indicated they won't be doing that already?
It's, I guess, my understanding that there was some plans to present, there was some question about that, whether they should go through the strategic planning process further before doing that. John, is that?
I would have to ask. I really don't know what their plans are for public outreach, and I don't want to sort of misspeak.
I mean, there were a lot of presentations being posted on the Metro website for a number of months, and then sort of things kind of went silent for a little while as far as the RTSP, and they came last month with a fairly detailed presentation, and I think that it seems like there's enough for some feedback and for things to be shared more broadly, and that hasn't yet happened. So if they're already going to do it, and we sent a letter saying but how about some public feedback, and they're already going to do it, then that's an easy win. They can easily comply.
Maybe if they were
going to
do things like they were soliciting feedback, or at least making the information publicly available in the beginning, and then Carol also maybe you could say something to the effect of praising how they handled it in the beginning and encouraging them to continue to do that. Would that address them?
Any other questions? Comments? Then we'll have a vote. All in favor of the motion? Any opposed? Any abstentions?
I don't know if it's something I don't understand fully. The issue that the letter is being sent, so that's why.
Motion passes. Okay, I guess we're into the period of open mic, and I'm going to start open mic by just reminding everyone that January is election time for the RAC. And I just thought I should let everybody know that I'm not even seeking to run again for the chair. And also to remind everyone that all of the terms are one-year terms, and so they all fall up in January. And also encourage folks to take some leadership role in the RAC. And step forward if you feel so inclined. If you have any questions about it in the next month, feel free to ask any of us about that. If you have any of the obligations or privileges.
Do you have a secret that is in post trade rivals on himself?
Let me tell you, the night I was elected chair the first time, that meeting went so late that I had to take a cab home from it. I said, I was just going to chair of the RAC, and Metro is making me take a cab home because there's no more buses at the terminal. So much for privilege. Also, the last thing I wanted to say is just to remind folks that the appointments to the RAC will be next week.
Next Thursday.
Next Thursday. And so that's when those people will be added to the email chain that we have, the email list. And so if you want to offer a letter or a statement of intent to run, it might be good to do it after that, although you are free to do it before that if you'd like. Just so that you can be sure that those folks will be receiving it as well. And you are welcome to offer a statement of intent at meeting if you want as well, or not. But folks in the past have offered statements of intent so that people know a little something about them. And, Joseph and then Dave.
If anyone else want to talk about this topic, I want to talk about it.
Yeah, I do. I just want to also, first of all, sad that Frank won't be continuing on because he's been such a fantastic chair. I also don't anticipate running for any positions as I've been vice chair for 2 years, and I think it would, I would like to see some of the other folks in the RAC, some of whom are. And most of them are very capable as well, take on some leadership positions going forward. So.
From my point more about the information we received before meetings, one thought, you tell me if you think that this just can't be done now, and I'll accept it, okay? when we receive these presentations, can they be posted to our site before the meeting?
Yeah, is there anything in specific?
I mean, like when we received the fair presentation right here.
Yeah, that should have been posted to our site.
Okay.
It was. I did last Friday. Now, I don't know. I've been having some issues with posting stuff.
Did it pop you out?
Well, it's been, I post it and there's a link. I post it and there's a link, and then you click on the link and it comes up with nothing.
Okay.
And so that's something I need to look into with IT. But this fair presentation was posted on the meeting page. I think there's discussion, and I may need to post it in an additional place to make it more visible to folks. And that's where I'm having an issue. The other stuff, like the annual report outline, was not posted because I finished that today, and I emailed it to you.
No, I mean, that's fine. I just wanted to, I think Carl made mention to it earlier, and we don't really get that much public input here, and so I try to send what we get to other people
okay.
to get their thoughts before the meeting, and help me ask questions as well,
mm-hmm.
and so
I don't remember when it was posted, I think it was the day we got it, I was raising it out to people, but if you're saying that it's going to be posted before the meeting, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I usually try and post the agenda and whatever stuff that I have that Friday when I send it out to you. But if there's other suggestions that people have in terms of how to make stuff more accessible, please feel free to let me know. And I'll be working with IT this week to try and clear up some technical issues that have been nagging us.
And you have the open mic. Bullets.
Happy
holidays, everyone. Enjoy the meeting. This is